something responding to a letter which was calling for saying arguing that if the bhikkhuni sangha is to be successful and established in the West, then one of the first things we need to do is to toss out all the rules. And that the word to toss them was used in the letter. And make up some new ones. So that's good, isn't it? We can get rid of all the old crusty rules and get some new shiny rules that will be just what we want to do. And one of the kind of interesting, I find interesting, fantasies of Westerners when they encounter Dhamma and Buddhism is that they somehow have this quite cute little delusion that they're the first people to have thought of these things. And they somehow have this conception that for 2,500 years, Buddhism has consisted of nothing but a mindless instantiation of a rigid straitjacket of set of rules which everybody follows without thinking or reflecting on them, and that now Buddhism's come to the West, finally we can be free of this kind of straitjacket. And needless to say, I just find that particular point of view a bit problematic. And it, in fact, is the case that within all monastic communities everywhere, and not just the Buddhist ones, that the living in a community demands a constant negotiation and dialogue with whatever the rules of the monastic life are. Anybody who's vaguely familiar with Buddhist tradition would know that the customs which are present in the monastic life of every Buddhist country, which you encounter on the surface of monastic life, in fact have very often a very tenuous relationship to the Vinaya as such. And the nature of Buddhist communities has always been to dialogue with the surrounding culture and to negotiate the degree of either acceptance or rejection of cultural norms and expectations within a Buddhist monastic context. And you know, some very obvious examples of this are the rules regarding the yakini worship that I talked a bit about in White Bones, Red Rot, where there's this, all these kind of series of allowances in the Mulasarvastivada Vinaya relating to the adoption of children from the local village, which seems to be a kind of a substitute sacrifice for yakini worship. So in the name of the local yakini, whether it be Hariti or one of the others, the village women would come and leave their children in the monastery for a period of time and then come and collect them. And during that time, of course, they had to be accommodated within the monastic rules, and the various allowances for them to have meals in the afternoon and so on are given. And so here, you know, you see the way that Buddhism's been adopting to these things. And typically, the general rule is that if something is intrinsically unwholesome, such as animal sacrifice or human sacrifice, something which actually causes harm to living beings, then the Buddhists simply reject it. We won't have a part of it. If something is skillful and useful, then it will be adopted. Like, for example, the habit of the monastics in the time of the Buddha to meet on the Uposatha day And when this was brought up to the Buddha, he said, "Oh, that's a good idea. Have meetings for harmony every so often, every fortnight or every week, and can recite the monastic rules and so on." And so that's good, and we adopt it. In other cases, they'll maybe be adopted with changes, so they'll be adapted rather than adopted to the Buddhist tradition. And some of those adaptions have become quite universal in Buddhism, others are very local and concern the adoption of Buddhism to a local environment. And that's been happening for 2,500 years. The Buddha himself did it. It's not something that started only after the Buddha passed away. The process of kind of rubbing up against monastic rules and finding the need to adapt them to a local environment has also been happening ever since the rules were put into place. And we'll find as we proceed with our study of the Vinaya that there's this constant process of questioning the rules, questioning their application, and that the Buddha was most open to adapting and changing those rules when it was necessary. On the other hand, when it was something which was actually involved unwholesome conduct, then he would be very adamant and would stick by it very strongly. So in our fervour to adapt Buddhism to kind of a Western way of being and way of living, we should not forget the skill and the competence with which traditional Buddhists have done this. And we should not, I think it's unwholesome to speak with cynicism and contempt of Buddhist cultures and of cultural ways of practice. These are things which are meaningful to people in a particular context. They may be practices that we don't personally want to adopt, or we don't want to adopt as a community, that's fine, but we should be respectful of the role that they play within a Buddhist context. We should also remember that whether or not we agree with the forms that Buddhism has taken in different cultures, the reality is that the traditions of monks and nuns, lay people in those countries, has for many hundreds, thousands of years been successful in conveying a Buddhist community and conveying the Buddhist message. We don't know whether we can achieve the same thing. Can we do what all the Buddhist countries have done? Can we sustain the building of a Sangha? Can we contribute to the passing down of the scriptures and the teachings? Can we communicate the Dhamma to those who need it? Can we provide the environment for people to practice Dhamma and to find liberation? All of these things are still really unknown for us. We're experimenting. And we need to be conscious and humble of the achievements of the Buddhists down through the ages who have succeeded in doing these things. Not perfectly, not in ways that we would agree with all the time, but nevertheless, the fact is there. The sasana has been sustained. We should also be quite conscious of the extent to which our own tradition, which we look back on, is in fact the outcome of a continual process of reform. It's not something which is static. It's not something which has been like that since the beginning. And just a very brief example of this within the Thai tradition. And we have this kind of idea we talk about, like the Thai tradition, or Thai monks are like this, or Thai Buddhism is like this, and so on and so forth. Thai Buddhism actually is extremely diverse, and it has been for more than 1,000 years. It's gone through lots of different phases. It's developed a lot of regional variations. There's a lot of corruption and a lot of decadence within Thai Buddhism, a tremendous amount of corruption and decadence. And yet there also is a tremendous amount of very positive practice of Dhamma as well. We can't reduce it to one or the other. In the mid-19th century, the then Prince Mongkut was ordained as a bhikkhu and was himself very dissatisfied with the state of the Thai Sangha. He decided that it was necessary to cast off the cultural forms that Thai Buddhism had accrued and to go back and look at the Buddha's original words within the Pali Canon to find what's the proper way to live and to practice Buddhism. As a result of his reforms, there gradually emerged the Dhammayut order. And even though it's true that there was and still is, a degree of conflict between the Dhammayut and the rest of the Thai Sangha, which came to be known as the Mahanikaya, still it's also true that within the writings of Mongkut himself, that there was a concern for making his reforms meaningful, but not insisting on little details of change which might cause unnecessary conflict. Now, the W order is essential to the foundation of what we know as modern Thai Buddhism. It was essentially a city-based study tradition, closely associated with the royal elite of Bangkok. It was an attempt to create a unified, purified, dogmatic school of Theravada in Thailand. When Ajahn Mun and the other early exponents of the forest tradition in Thailand wished to devote themselves to practice, they were influenced by that movement. One of Ajahn Mun's childhood friends was a monk by the name of Upali, who became one of the great Jalkuns, one of the great teaching administrative monks in Bangkok in that period. This is the early part of the 20th century. And he, Ajahn Mun, remained in contact with Jalkun Upali throughout his life. And his Jalkun Upali's sort of knowledge of the Pali Canon and his insistence on a more rational approach to Dhamma, less superstitious, less involved with black magic and all of the weird and wonderful kinds of practices, and more insistence on the central orthodox meditations of breath meditation, body contemplation, these kinds of things, as well as a rigorous vinaya practice. All of these were developed by Ajahn Mun in the forest tradition in dialogue with his childhood friend Jalkun Upali, which is not to say, of course, that the forest tradition, you know, always got along particularly well with the city monks. On the contrary, there was a lot of conflict, and the agenda of the Dhammayut city monks and also Mahanikaya city monks became much more focused on maintaining a sense of sort of cultural continuity and trying to encourage kind of a widespread keeping of the kind of the basic Buddhist faith, dana, and keeping of precepts, rather than Ajahn Mun's focus on a dedicated practice for liberation. And so there was conflict in quite regularly throughout those traditions. of course, from the Ajahn Mun and the forest tradition, developed Ajahn Chah, and then from Ajahn Chah came to the Western monastics, Ajahn Sumedho, and then the other senior Western monks, and Ajahn Brahm, and from there to us, sort of gradually going downhill as it goes, I guess. So it's important to recognize that when we do our investigations, reforms of the tradition, that we're not doing something which is radically different in kind from what has been done within those traditions themselves. The details of what we're doing vary, but the principles and the methods and so on are essentially similar to those done by other Buddhists in our direct tradition, as well as by other Buddhists in other traditions around the world. And so when we recognize this continuity, which is neither a kind of unsullied, you know, permanent transmission of a self-identical Dhamma throughout the ages, nor is it a revolutionary reinvention of the teaching in each generation, but is an evolutionary thing, an accretion of gradual adaptive changes. Then we get some more idea of how we should be moving, how we should be changing to develop our own tradition. And Charles Darwin said that adaption didn't mean that the strongest survive or the fastest survive or anything like that. What it means is that those species survive which are most responsive to change. And I think it's axiomatic that our age is changing faster than any age previously. We are children of that change. We've grown up thinking that it's normal to see technology changing from year to year. But this is unique. I think it's unique to our generation, or maybe a few generations back, to see it like this. Most people, most of the time, saw continuity and consistency and a relatively much very slow change, or change that was quite arbitrary if it happened. So in our response to change, we have to be it's very challenging for us. It's not something which is easy to do, and something which we have to we don't know what the outcome is. I mean, who knows? Maybe the world's going to collapse. Maybe 2012 is going to really happen. Everything's going to fall apart. Maybe there'll be a nuclear war. Maybe the world environment will just fall apart. Maybe the oil will run out and civilization will collapse. We really don't know. These are things which we can't affect in any great degree. We can make our voice heard. We can try to make a voice for contentment, for moderation, for peace. We can try to make this voice heard as part of the world community, but in terms of the big picture, we really can't do all that much. And so when we're developing our monastic community, as well as our feeling of like evolving from those Buddhist traditions, we're also responding to the contemporary environment. We do that when we, for example, build our monastery and we try to use solar power. We try to use low wattage LED lights to help the environment. All of these things. It's part of how we're trying to learn how to adapt our practice of Dhamma into our present context. So all of these things, this becomes a very complex situation, the inheritance, the textual inheritance, comparative studies, the expectations of the tradition, the expectations of different cultural communities, the increasing emotional and psychological stresses in society at large, which manifest in the community, increasing incidence of things like depression and stress and so on within the community, the need to develop a monastery within an uncertain economic climate, all of these things impact on what we're doing here. So within all of that, we need to keep a sense of perspective. We need to keep a reference point, a standing ground, so that we don't get swamped by too many expectations, too much change. So that we don't get exhausted and burnt out by our monastic demands on us. So it's okay to get a bit honest about things from time to time. Yeah? It's all right, me and my practice. That's what I want to do. And I encourage that. Sometimes, not all the time. And as you know, people are encouraged to take a retreat from now and then. And people come up and say, listen, I'd like to take a couple of weeks retreat. And whenever it's possible, then I always say, that's fine, please, go ahead and do that. Also that people are encouraged to not work in the afternoon. And you're encouraged to after the mealtime is finished, to leave this central building, go back to your kuti, back to your whatever you stay in, a tree root or whatever, and just have some time off, some time to yourself. Sometimes it's necessary to do some work, but keep that as minimum as possible. Learn to be efficient in what you're doing. Learn to get things done without a fuss and without a bother, so that we can get the necessary things out of the way and then focus on the important things. Keep things simple and streamlined. And even if you have, you know, a lot of work and projects and things, then just say, well, I'm not going to do that. I'm just going to go back to my kuti and meditate. And so that's always the most important thing. So you remember that. Don't lose sight of that. It's the most important thing. And when we set up this monastery, I take inspiration from different aspects of monastic life, both that I've read about in the texts and that I've experienced in real life. In terms of the general schedule that we use here is very similar to that which is used in Bodhinyana. We have breakfast in the morning, chores time, and then chores time during the week, and then lunchtime, have the afternoon off, drinks at 6, and we don't have morning and evening meetings, compulsory morning and evening meetings every day, optional, People are encouraged to come in the morning or in the evening and meditate if they want to, but we're not forcing you to do that. But we certainly encourage you to do your practice, if you're not coming in here, to do your practice in your kuti, in your room or your caravan, whatever you have in private. And as you know, I myself much prefer to do my practice in private and in solitude. So you all have an individual dwelling place that's very rare. Most monasteries in most places, if you go through Thailand, probably 95% of the monasteries in Thailand consist of just rooms one next to the other. That's how monastics live. Similarly in Sri Lanka, similarly in ancient India, almost all of the monasteries that have been discovered in ancient India, they're just like a square building with rooms next to one another surrounding a central courtyard. That's how monastics live. And most of the monasteries in Thailand still have a similar kind of arrangement, or just like a kind of series of rooms along a corridor. In Korea, everyone sleeps in a hall together. That's your kind of your environment. In many of even the forest monasteries in Thailand and Malaysia that I've been to, the kutis may be you maybe have individual kutis, which may be only like a meter apart from each other. And that's how a lot of the monks live in those places. And so everybody here has much more than that, even though we know we need to improve our accommodation, but you have a chance to have this wonderful bush environment, wonderful forest. The degree of solitude and seclusion that we have here is almost unknown in most Asian countries, apart from a very few forest monasteries that I know of in Thailand and a few in other places, that this kind of setup is just impractical in most of the world. There's just these days just too many people. And so I strongly encourage you to make use of this seclusion, and even go further out, go exploring in the national park, on these hot afternoons. Why not go down and spend some time, find a creek or a waterfall somewhere over in the national park, and you can spend your time down there doing some meditation, finding a cave or a ledge in the cliff somewhere. So all of these things are part of the resources that we have to support our practice. When we living from day to day in the monastery, we should keep a sense of proportion and a sense of balance about where we are at, what we're doing, how we're living our life. There should always be some study of the Dhamma. There should always be some attention to the work that needs to be done to run the monastery. There should always be some meditation. How much effort we put into these things will vary from time to time. And we need to be checking ourselves as to what we're doing at any one time, not letting any of these things be lost. They're all important. But also it's important that we have a realistic expectation of what we can do. If we come to sit meditation and our meditation is complete crap and it's just rubbish and we're sitting there and we can't manage to string two breaths together, and it's been like that for the last year, right? Then you know, be realistic about that. You're not going to get into jhanas anytime soon, right? That's the bad news. And bashing your head against a wall and expecting to somehow get good samadhi out of nothing is a bit foolish. If the meditation is very difficult, we're really struggling, then keep up your meditation practice, doing it regularly and gently, but put more, a little bit more effort into those other foundational teachings. Put some more effort into doing some simple practical work around the monastery, doing some raking, some sweeping, bit of carpentry, whatever. And trying to keep the mindfulness of your body. Put more effort into just walking and being with nature and just keeping the mindfulness. And especially in study and memorizing of the suttas and the chanting. And these things are very good for helping to give more concentration where it's lacking. On the other hand, if you have very good meditation, and you find that you can, your breath becomes very bright and clear and you can just stay with the meditation very well, then that's great. Then pursue that as much as you can and try to gently and with respect to distance yourself from other activities in the monastery. That's not in a sense of giving unnecessary burdens to other people or anything like that. It's just a matter of acknowledging that if now's the time for putting special effort into your meditation, then really try to make that your priority. Don't feel that you're kind of required to sort of act in a social way or to be hanging around talking to people or to be volunteering for extra jobs when you're really sort of eager to keep pursuing your meditation. That's also something which is very valuable in the community and something which is a great heritage of Santi Monastery, that we've had a sort of a constant presence of, if you like, true recluses here. And of course the great paradigm for that is Venerable Mahesi. He's such a quiet young man who stayed here for, I'm not sure, 2 or 3 years, and that whole time is totally dedicated to meditation, would do his work, whatever needs to be done, and when that's finished, and then going back and doing his practice. And then that was always just entirely supported by the community here. So if that's where you're at, then do that and be comfortable with that, and other people should also be comfortable and help to support you in that. So we all have our role, and some people's role is to be having a more active helping role within a community, serving. Some people's role is to be doing more study or academic work. Some people's role is to be doing more teaching. Some people's role to be quiet and setting an example of a secluded meditator. Some people's role is to go and collapse in a heap on the floor in their kuti and sob their eyes out, because that's also okay. And by doing that, then you're setting a good example for others that it's all right. But from time to time, you can do that as well. So our monastic community, we have certain things that we're unified by. And we're unified by our commitment to the Dhamma and Vinaya. We're unified by our commitment to the idea of developing a community of bhikkhus and bhikkhunis, laymen and laywomen, in a modern Australian context. We're unified by our desire and interest in basing that community on a realistic assessment and understanding of the Buddha's teachings. We're unified by our recognition that the bush, the Australian bush environment, is a wonderful support for meditation and contemplation practice. And so these are the things which are very central, have always been central, and which are the basic reason why I wanted to set up a monastery here and try to attract people to come and share in this way of practice. And within that, then, of course, we also have a degree of diversity in terms of our backgrounds, our interests, our capacities, and so on. And we need to accept and encourage that diversity just as much as we accept and encourage the unity. And so this is that quality of mudita, is to rejoice in the good qualities of others. Even if they're not the same as our good qualities, even sometimes we can't understand them. Some people can look at it and think, well, I don't know why they're doing that, but anyway, it's good stuff anyway. So whatever kind of contribution we can make to the monastic community is always valuable and is enriching the culture that we're creating here. So probably enough talking for this evening, and thank you all for listening. And I don't know if anyone has any comments or questions. So let everybody know, a piece of good news that we've been, the FABC and ASA have been successful in our attempt to get the Dhammapada included in the House of Representatives in Canberra. So they'll be organising an official delegation from the Buddhist community to go and place the Dhammapada together with the Bible and the Quran in the, what they call, the dispatcher's box in the House of Representatives. So it should be fun. I have this fantasy. We were discussing about like which text it should be and so on, and I had this kind of fantasy that, you know, maybe sometime, you know, there'd be some kind of dark night in the House of Reps and they've been arguing all day and blah 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 and they're feeling despairing, and then somebody will seek for some spiritual inspiration and they'll actually open this box and pick it up, and they'll kind of open it up and say, oh, hatred is never eased by hatred, it's only solved by loving kindness. And then they'll say, oh, that's right.